WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere. WNYC Studios is supported by the Public Theater, presenting the world premiere of Jordans, a new play by Ife Olujobi about two young Black colleagues forced together and torn apart by their race, ambition, and otherworldly circumstances. Directed by Whitney White, begins April 11th. Learn more at publictheater.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly during the week. Now, on yesterday's show, we spent a little time on the case of State Senator Schneiderman running for Attorney General, as we just heard from Bob, who was involved in a fender bender hit and run. We wanted to know just what constituted a tap and what made for a hit. The consensus was it's okay to leave if it was just a tap, but not if it was a hit. At the very end of the segment, we got this call from Tom in Oakbridge.
Okay, there was a law in the late 70s saying a car had to withstand a 5-mile-an-hour crash, or safety equipment. Reagan repealed that. Anybody who has a car from the early 80s remembers the bumper stuck out about 2 or 3 inches. It was a political decision Reagan did to repeal that. This car would have had no damage.
That was literally the last call we got on the show yesterday, so we didn't have time to fact check. Turns out, Tom's right. As part of his pledge to reduce the regulatory burden on industry, in May of 1982, President Reagan had the National Highway Transportation Administration amend the bumper standard in new cars. The crash test speeds for front and rear bumpers went from 5 miles per hour to 2.5 miles per hour, and the corner crash test speeds from 3 miles an hour to 1.5. So there you have it. Not sure how fast Senator Schneiderman's car was going, but had this been 1982 and he'd been driving, say, an El Camino, perhaps none of this would have been an issue because there would have been no damage to the other car. Moving on with Follow-Up Friday, there's this.
Batting fifth, the left fielder, number 8, Yogi Berra, number 8. Playing first base, number 23, Don Mattingly, number 23.
There it is, that unmistakable voice of Bob Shepard, the legendary Yankees stadium announcer who passed away this last weekend. The Yankees are honoring him along with George Steinbrenner at the stadium tonight and tomorrow. So let's revisit a couple of Bob Shepard angles. For one, a particular quirk in his delivery that we here at the show can't exactly figure out. Take another listen to his lineup announcement. This from a tribute video to him that the Yankees put together. Listen closely to when he lists the player numbers.
The designated hitter, number 44. Reggie Jackson, number 44. Batting ninth, the second baseman, number 1, Billy Martin, number 1.
Number 1. And that was Shepard's standard delivery. Player position, player number, player name, and player number again. Why repeat the number? We asked around the station. No good theories. We put in a request with the Yankees press office. No answer. So now we ask you, if you are listening and you know why Bob Shepard repeated the player number, didn't say the name twice, didn't say the position twice. He figured we got that one time around, but he gave us the number twice. Number 2, Derek Jeter, number 2. Why did he do that? Did he think we couldn't register it the first time? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you know that piece of Bob Shepard trivia. Several theories that have been floated. Shepard was quoted as saying, "A PA announcer is not a cheerleader or a circus barker or a hometown screecher. He's a reporter." So perhaps this was his tribute to the facts and just the facts. Another theory, it has to do with those scoring the game. It helps them keep track and reminds them of the player number. And the Yankees don't have names on the back of their jerseys, as many teams do, so the number is that much more important. That's my theory. But we haven't gotten a definitive answer. If you know or have a good theory, let us know. 212-433. Oh, look, our lines are already full with people on that one. In the meantime, let's talk about a bit more about Shepard with Ben Zimmer, the on-language columnist for The New York Times. He writes every other week about words, phrases, and the changing English language in the magazine, more frequently on the website. He's here today to discuss Shepard's particular way of speaking and what we consider now that old-timey way of talking that makes his delivery so majestic but such a throwback. Hey, Ben. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
First of all, do you have a theory as to why Bob Shepard repeated player numbers?
I don't really know, although it could very well have come out of his training as a speech teacher. And, you know, obviously that fed into the way that he enunciated the players' names and numbers so carefully. And so perhaps he, by repeating that was a kind of almost a rhetorical flourish to give closure to that particular announcement.
All right. Good theory. Now on to why you're really here. How is it that a kid born in Richmond Hill, Queens, ended up sounding like that? And here's a little more Bob Shepard. This is a very unusual clip, actually. This is from June of 1968, where he asks the stadium crowd for a moment of silence upon the death of Robert Kennedy.
Now we ask for a moment of respectful silence in memory of Senator Robert F. Kennedy.
And Ben, you wrote a piece yesterday in Visual Thesaurus, a website you run, in which you said that Shepard's passing marks the end of an era, a final vestige of an approach to spoken language that has now been largely abandoned. What's been abandoned?
Well, we know that one thing that's been abandoned is kind of a focus on public speaking in that developed in the U.S. There were students would learn from people like Bob Shepard, who taught at both the high school and college level. They would learn formal speaking. They would learn how to enunciate all the different aspects of elocution. Well, that's pretty much a lost art now. But the fact that he was trained in that, it comes through in his voice whenever we hear that. So that's one way that, as you say, just hearing him make those announcements really sounds like a throwback.
And let's take another listen to some more clips, both of these from Meet the Press, not Yankee Stadium, both exchanges between male reporters and prominent females. The first is from Meet the Press in 1968, an interview with Shirley Temple Black about her work at the UN.
Mrs. Black, when you first came to the United Nations last September, you expressed the hope that you might be able to make a contribution to peace. Have you succeeded, and to what extent?
Well, I think this is a hard one for all 126 countries. Most of the delegates there are trying very hard to achieve peace.
And now, Christina Romer, President Obama's economic advisor, and David Gregory, the current host of Meet the Press. This is from just last year. Listen to how differently each of them speaks.
We've seen huge job loss. We've seen very large falls in GDP. So certainly in the short run, we're in a bad situation.
All right, but then what's different between now and then, when the economy was in even better shape than it is now?
I think what we're saying is that the where we are today is obviously not good.
Now, Ben Zimmer, we just heard a few individuals in those clips, to be fair. But is there a generational difference in speaking styles that's reflected?
Well, I think there's a generational shift that happened in terms of public speaking, the kind of speech that's on display. How we talk when we're just among friends and speaking informally, perhaps that hasn't changed so radically. But certainly in terms of public speaking, the way that we expect public figures like politicians to speak has definitely changed. I mean, if you just think about presidents, really not since John F. Kennedy has there been a president who has had that kind of approach to rhetoric and that what we now think of as a kind of an older style of public speaking. President Obama, of course, is a very, very eloquent speaker, and people recognize that. But at the same time, he's always fending off allegations that he's too professorial. So in some ways, what we expect from our public speakers has to be more informal, more colloquial than it has in the past.
Some theories on our Facebook page about this. Matthew writes, in broadcast voices, announcers, etc., they pronounce the H more strongly in WH words such as white, while, whistle, like Bob Shepard at that time. Tamara on Facebook, I wasn't around in 1960, but it would seem that we speak much faster without the social filters that used to be required and spend a lot less time choosing our words. And I don't know about choosing our words and whether we spend less time. I'm not quite sure what she means by social filters, but I wonder if it's kind of a class thing or sort of a populist thing. Maybe there was more respect in the past for people who sounded like they were somehow upper class, certainly in the political sector. And now we tend to distrust those people. And so people in the media don't sound like Walter Cronkite or Bob Shepard anymore. People in politics, well, same thing.
There's something to that, definitely. Although all through American history, there has been what's been called democratic eloquence, an idea that to be truly eloquent, you had to express the voice of the people. But what's happened, certainly over the last few decades, has been a move to more populist speech. That's definitely true. So we find that in the move away from the more sort of traditional rhetorical models that we might associate with people like Bob Shepard, or if we hear FDR, those sorts of voices.
On our comments page, Cindy writes, I've been watching Mad Men lately, and I'm struck by the memories of people, how people used to speak. Speech has definitely changed since the 60s. The cadence is faster, and enunciation nowadays is sloppy. Not to mention our speech lacks the niceties of polite conversation. Here's a clip from Mad Men.
The most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion.
Now, again, that's an actor playing somebody from a period, but they're trying for some authenticity on this show, and I know you're writing about Mad Men. Does that reflect something?
Well, we have to be careful, of course, in thinking that what we hear on Mad Men is somehow a time capsule or a documentary reflecting the way people spoke back then. They do definitely strive for authenticity on that show, but there is a lot of careful speaking on that show. And we sometimes have an idea that people in the past spoke more carefully because of how we were exposed to films and mass media that presents people speaking in this particular way, and we assume that's the way people spoke all the time. As I said before, though, informal or colloquial speech has always been there, even if it hasn't always been on display in films and so forth. And certainly in the 1960s, that changed a lot in terms of what would be shown, and so we end up getting more sort of colloquial speech displayed that way.
We just have a minute left. Let's get a couple of these theories as to why Bob Shepard said the uniform number twice. Julia in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Do it real concisely, okay?
Hi, I'm a rabbi, and I was told always to announce page numbers twice in services because people don't really process it the first time.
Great one. Good theory. Thank you. Danny on Long Island City, you're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great show. Big Mets fan, but I think that the reason he did it was one of the things the Yankees do as opposed to other teams is they don't have their names on the back of their jerseys.
Right. I'm going to leave it there. Definitely one of the theories. I think you're probably right about that. Pearl in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I think that it was just for the cadence and the balance. You know, number two, Derek Jeter, number two, and then he paused and went to the next one.
And that was your theory, Ben Zimmer, on language columnist for the New York Times.
Yes, I like that theory. It definitely displays his training in elocution and rhetoric that he should have a nice, full announcement like that, ending with good closure with the number.
Although, speaking of closure, Mark on our comments page, getting the final word in this segment, writes, well, baseball is a slow game, so Shepard was trying to fill some time by saying the number twice. Ben Zimmer, thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.